Good Monday morning. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. A new study by the Environmental Integrity Project reveals that hundreds of millions of gallons of raw sewage were dumped into the Jones Falls in the Inner Harbor, some of which found its way into more than 400 homes in the city of Baltimore. The author of the report, Tom Pelton, joins me along with Jeffrey Raymond of the Department of Public Works to examine the city's overwhelmed sewer system. Then, from the latest with the trial of Officer Cesar Goodson to Governor Hogan's demolition plan for parts of blighted areas of East and West Baltimore, a roundup of other important local stories with Yvonne Wenger from the Baltimore Sun, Jane Miller from WBAL Television, and attorney Ed Smith. And rapper Abdu Ali sits down with producer Jonna McCone to discuss being gay in hip-hop, Baltimore club and soul music, and his dance party series called Kalan. Plus, our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick reviews Moonlight and Magnolias at the Spotlighters Theater. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for being with us this morning. Hope you had a good weekend. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Last month, the Environmental Integrity Project issued a report commissioned by the Able Foundation. It says that hundreds of millions of gallons of sewage are being pumped into the Jones Falls in the Inner Harbor, and that the city has consistently underreported the volume of raw waste that is released from its aging system of pipes. In 2002, the city signed a consent decree with the EPA and the Maryland Department of the Environment to settle a lawsuit requiring the city to fix this enormous problem. To pay for the fixes, the city tripled our water and sewer rates. The Department of Public Works estimates that about $700 million has been spent so far on improvements to the aging system, but last week, after 13 years, the city missed the deadline to complete the work. Tom Pelton is the lead author of the study, which is called Stopping the Flood Beneath Baltimore's Streets. He's also the host of the Environment in Focus here on WIPR, which is sponsored by the Able Foundation, the same sponsor of the report. He joins me in the studio. Joining us on the phone is Jeffrey Raymond. He's the Chief of Communications and Community Affairs at the Department of Public Works here in Baltimore. Jeff Raymond,
great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for being here. And Tom, good to see you. Tom, I wonder if you could just give us an overview about what's happening. How is it that we're sort of intentionally pumping sewage into the Jones Falls?
Well, not really intentionally.
It is intentional. The city is intentionally.
Well, Jeff, we'll give you a chance here in a second, but let's have Tom sort of summarize what's in the report, and then I'll ask you to respond.
All right.
Yeah, what we found is that the city is intentionally piping raw sewage into the Jones Falls, which goes right into the Inner Harbor in large amounts. 335 million gallons intentionally piped into the Jones Falls over the last 5 years. And this is because the city's system is badly decayed. It's overwhelmed. Whenever it rains, a lot of the water gets into the cracks in the pipes, and it can't handle all of the stormwater mixed with sewage in the system. So the city has, it's kind of like a relief valve. It's a relief pipe that when it is raining and the system's overwhelmed, it'll release this sewage into the Jones Falls, and it goes right into the Inner Harbor. The problem is the city is not following the law and reporting to the public when it has these large sewage overflows. The state law requires any overflow of more than 10,000 gallons to have a press release issued so the public is notified about it. And by state policy, the city is supposed to report it to the Maryland Department of the Environment's Public Sewage Overflow Database. The city has not been doing that. Over the last 5 years, if you look on that database, only 22 million gallons of sewage has been reported as being released. In fact, it's 15 times that amount. So the city is not reporting it to this MDE public database, and it's not issuing press releases as required by law.
All right. So, Jeff Raymond, let's take those one at a time.
There's a lot that just happened. Now, let's start with the most recent part about the press releases and notifying the public. This is critical stuff. We absolutely report overflows of 10,000 gallons.
Not true.
And we absolutely report those overflows from those two remaining structured overflows in our quarterly reports to our state regulators.
But not to the public, as required by law.
Okay.
The state regulator is a public agency, Tom.
But it's not to the public.
Okay,
a press release is to the public.
Before we get to the reporting and who's getting the reports, Jeff Raymond, if there is an overflow, if the pipes are filled up, you have, as you say, these two remaining pipes that are doing this overflow.
These are structured overflows.
Structured overflows, meaning that they are intentional, that you have to put them there. Because if you didn't put them into the Jones Falls, aren't you worried that they would back up into people's homes? And to date, there are more than 400 people in the city who have filed lawsuits about because they've had this horrible sewage pumped into their, you know, ending up in their basement. So if it doesn't go into the Jones Falls, where would it go?
Well, it would continue to back up and further up into people's homes. And so by keeping them open, you're right. We do avoid the situation of having worse sewer backups than we would. It's important to note, again, that initially in the early stages of our consent decree, we found 62 of these structured overflows throughout the city. And we close all but these last two. These last two are going to be closed over the next coming years thanks to a program at the Back River Wastewater Treatment Plant, a very complex, very expensive program that we refer to as the Headworks Project. So we do have a plan in place, and we will be putting out bids as soon as this month to begin that project.
So
that
you're
will
saying...
close, allow us eventually to close those two remaining overflows.
You literally are saying that there's no other place for it to go than the Inner Harbor?
There's no other place for it to go than into the Jones Falls, where it was, believe it or not, many, many years ago when this old 100-year-plus system was designed to do.
Right,
now remember, we're talking about a system, again, that's more than 100 years old. It was designed to meet old standards that did not have the tight environmental requirements that, thank goodness, we do today.
Sure. So, Tom Pelton, if it didn't go into the Jones Falls, it would end up in people's basements. What are you supposed to do in the interim between now and when this thing finally gets fixed, these final two pipes?
The point we're trying to make in the report is that the city was given 14 years and almost $1 billion to address this problem, to stop the overflows, and they haven't done it yet. So
we haven't finished.
You've done about half,
the job,
as we say in the report, about half of the projects required by the consent decree.
And we have a plan in place. We have not stopped. The January 1st deadline has indeed come and gone, but that hasn't changed what we're doing here. We are absolutely focused on meeting our requirements to secure a system-wide fix, and that will be our goal going forward.
But Jeff Raymond,
it's
been 14 years. You've collected $2 billion from ratepayers in the city of Baltimore, and it hasn't been done. What would lead us to be confident that you can get it done in the next few years, as you say?
When the new extension comes out, and unfortunately I don't have a good date for
this.
You
this is an extension to the consent decree.
To the consent decree. You will see a rather specific set of requirements and a plan that we have, a comprehensive plan, to make sure that we are treating our waterways, cleaning our waterways, and treating the sewage as we have to do going forward, as opposed to the plan we inherited designed 100 years ago.
There's some talk that the city is asking for as much as a 10-year extension on this consent decree. That seems like a long time, and if that's 10 more years of pumping sewage into the Jones Falls, how can anybody find that acceptable?
Well, I can't go into the details of the consent decree extension because, again, it has not been made public yet. So if it's not public, I really can't comment publicly on it. But what I can tell you is the Headworks Project is going to alleviate as much as 83% of the ongoing overflows that we're seeing throughout the city. That is not a 10-year project. That's a project that we're going to see by, well, let me put it this way, it won't be 10 years. The terms are going to be discussed in public when we take this to bid. Again, should be this month. We'll be able to talk about it in much greater detail.
Yeah.
But
certainly, sir, you can understand people's frustration that after 13 or 14 years, you're just halfway through with $2 billion in the bank to address this problem.
That's money that's being spent all along. This was a project that began at the beginning, which was designing a program that was going to meet all the needs of the city.
But money isn't the problem in this case, right? You've got the funds to do the work. Is that correct?
We feel comfortable where we are now, but there's much more work ahead. This is the point that we're trying to make. We have a plan, we have a program, and it's going to be moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And Tom Pelton, in the meantime, it's often not safe to be, for example, in a kayak in the Inner Harbor. Your report talks about experts from outside the DPW doing studies. And
we gave data on water quality monitoring in the Inner Harbor to Edward Bauer, a water quality expert at Johns Hopkins. And he gave the opinion that really the bacteria levels are so high, more than a third of the time using conservative standards, they're too high for limited water contact recreation, like the kayaking that sometimes people do in the harbor, or even the dragon boats. The bacteria levels in the harbor are too high. And so really what Ed Bauer of Johns Hopkins was saying is that the city should post a warning sign at the Inner Harbor to say, don't have contact with the water, high bacteria levels. The city does post these signs occasionally along streams or along locations of sewage spills, but the bacteria levels in the Inner Harbor itself are so high, according to the Johns Hopkins expert, they should also post it at the Inner Harbor so people know this is a serious problem.
Yeah. There's one, there's a group in the Inner Harbor saying that, you know, make the water in the Inner Harbor literally safe to swim in by 2020. Jeff Raymond, is that feasible?
We aim to continue to make progress toward that goal. I can't tell you about 2020 sitting here at the beginning of 2016, but I can tell you that we have worked to clean up what we inherited years ago, and we are continuing to work to clean up those streams moving forward. We do anticipate that our streams are going to be cleaner, our harbor is going to be cleaner. We're working not just with our sewer system, but with our stormwater runoff program.
But you anticipate that the harbor, for example, is going to be cleaner in a few years, not anytime soon.
No, but then again, we didn't get here soon. This is a problem that was essentially a century in the making.
Yeah. All right. So we're running out of time.
One
Tom
problem,
the last word.
Yeah. One problem the city can solve immediately is the public reporting. In our report, we give 119 examples over the last 5 years of sewage dumping of more than 10,000 gallons. Only three times did the city follow the state law and issue press releases.
So that one, unfortunately, gentlemen, we are out of time. Gentlemen,
it's absolutely true.
A whole different thing.
So, gentlemen, we're out of time, and we can't sit here and adjudicate whether you're reporting or not. We're going to have to leave that for another time. I appreciate Jeff Raymond, your time, as well as you, Tom Pelton. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeff Raymond is the Chief of Communications and Community Affairs at the Baltimore Department of Public Works. Tom Pelton is the Director of Communications at the Environmental Integrity Project. It's a nonprofit organization that advocates for enforcement of environmental laws. He's one of the authors of Stopping the Flood Beneath Baltimore Streets, a report commissioned by the Abel Foundation. We've got a link to the report on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. More after the news.
Thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Morning, everybody. Let's now take a look at some of the other important local stories in the news these days. Joining me in the studio is Jane Miller, who heads the investigative team at WBAL Television. Good to see you, Jane.
Hey, Tom.
And Yvonne Wenger joins us as well. She reports on local government for the Baltimore Sun. Hey, Yvonne.
Hi.
Joining us on the phone is Edward Smith, an attorney in private practice here in Baltimore, who's been helping us untangle the legal issues around the trials of the officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray. Jury selection in the trial of Officer Cesar Goodson begins today. So, Ed Smith, Judge Williams ruled that Officer William Porter has to testify in Officer Goodson's trial. Officer Porter appealed that ruling. Where does it stand, and how is it likely to be resolved?
First, Tom, good morning to you, your studio guests, and to your listenership. Where we are right now is there has been a response by the state, a quite extensive response, claiming that obviously that any right which we have against self-incrimination can in fact be trumped That means simply that it's not always so that anything that you say may not incriminate you. It may not incriminate you if there are no consequences. And that's what the Court of Special Appeals has to decide based on a case called Castigar versus the United States of America. And now, so, yeah, I'm sorry, Tom, go ahead.
I'm sorry, can the trial of Officer Goodson proceed without a ruling one way or the other from the Court of Special Appeals?
Well, yes, it can, because if there is an independent source to convict Goodson that is brought by the state and it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, despite the fact that they don't have the other testimony from the officer, it's only their theory that that testimony would help them and secure a conviction, and that's not necessarily the case.
So you would assume that, you know, they're going to select a jury, or begin selecting a jury today, and then the trial will proceed, and is it likely that the Court of Special Appeals is going to take a day, 3 days, 4 days to figure this out? Wouldn't they need to figure it out right away?
Well, no, because the state can deal with the pace of any trial, and they can always put the officer who has to testify in at any time during their trial, and the court can, in its discretion, even if the defense puts on the case, have him as a rebuttal witness or however the state intends to do it. It's all a matter of strategy in trial work, and nothing is set in stone. The court may rule, and I would assume that the court will rule before that trial is over. Jury selection is going to take some time. Opening statements, voir dire, everything has to be put in place. That's the process of trial work.
All right. Well, Ed, as always, we appreciate your time, and we will have you back in soon to continue giving us commentary on this second trial in the six
officers. Oh, it's been a pleasure. Hi, Jane.
Hey, Ed. How are you?
All right.
Take care.
All right. Appreciate it, Ed. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
So Yvonne Winger, another big story in the news this week, is that in the Gilmore Homes case, where it was alleged that maintenance workers were demanding sexual favors in return for doing maintenance work, that people who were part of that lawsuit that was filed in September will share up to about $8 million in the settlement of that class action lawsuit. I talked on Friday afternoon to Perry Hopkins. He's an organizer with Communities United, and I asked him what the reaction has been from the residents there.
All of the women are happy that the Housing Commission has stepped up to take some type of accountability. They're also happy that it's now almost to its close, to where there has been a settlement reached. There is a lot of speculation about how long it'll take, because they had to live with the pain and suffering for an awful long time. A lot of the women are looking forward to getting the settlement so they can really move somewhere else for themselves and their children. There has been a process in place by housing to avail them alternative housing. It's been a long and arduous process. There's a lot of bureaucracy hooked to it. I spoke with Mr. Graziano today in reference to simplifying that process for those people who still remain in their units. Communities United and the public housing community has one great concern. As I was there Christmas and in the past week, there's still people with no heat. Some of the repairs now need to be prioritized. There's going to be a six-month window between the time that the monetary portion of the settlement is rendered, pending approval by HUD and the feds. That's a good size window for us to begin to judge and evaluate how much actual progress.
So, Yvonne Winger, you were at the press conference that Mr. Graziano held Friday afternoon. How is it that a settlement's been reached, but they haven't yet determined who is going to be eligible to take part in that settlement? What's the next step for those residents?
So they define the class as anybody who says that they have been sexually harassed or abused going back 3 years, which is the statute of limitations. If you have repairs at your home that were left undone because of alleged sexual harassment or abuse, you can also join the class. So once the settlement amount is approved by HUD and the U.S. District Court, as it's expected in the coming weeks, there will be a 60-day window for anybody who is a member of that class to contact a yet-to-be-named administrator to be vetted to see if you can qualify.
Perry Hopkins did tell me on Friday that some improvements have been made. They've restored exterior lighting to some of the particularly dark passageways and alleys around the homes. They've cleaned up the grounds a little bit, but there's still a lot to be done. Jane Miller, you're one of the few people who actually has interviewed Paul Graziano, who is notorious for being gun-shy when it comes to
his amazing career in Baltimore.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I mean, it is
since
amazing.
It's 15 years of, you know.
And being controversial for most of that
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. From the jump, he was controversial.
From the jump. What accounts for his longevity and his staying power?
Tom, that's like a $1 million question in many quarters that how's he... Well, first of all, it's a complicated job in that you're really the head of two agencies, the Housing and Community Development and then the Housing Authority, which is really a federal agency, and operates under a whole different set of kind of standards of secrecy and non-transparency in some cases. But, you know, I think there's a much broader issue here, which doesn't seem to get talked about. We have, Yvonne, fifth largest?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're the 20-something...
26th largest city.
City in the country. We have the eighth largest police force and the fifth largest...
Public housing.
Right. So what's wrong with this picture? And we just don't seem to want to have that much broader conversation about here we are now 2016, all these years later, and people are still living in these, you know, red brick, you know, no opportunity communities. No opportunity because the jobs aren't there. And is this the way we want, is this what we want us to be, where we kind of confine poor people, et cetera? The other thing is that we have I've always understood from, you know, the folks I know as social services administrators is that Maryland is kind of unusual in that there's no limit on how long you live in these properties. We have people that have lived in public housing their entire lives.
Which generations
means,
now.
Correct. Yeah. Which means for the young single mother, you know, that's looking for, at least a half decent place to live, it may not exist because those options have been locked down for so long. And this is a difficult conversation. I understand that. But in the broad picture of affordable housing and decent housing and housing that makes sense, and when I say housing that makes sense has to be housing that is where people are able to get to work in a reasonable amount of time and in a reasonable fashion, where there is safety and where there are half-decent schools or decent schools nearby.
Sure.
And that's not the case.
And
in
this
Baltimore.
Is all, of course, tied in with, you know, the governor's decision to bag the red line and, you know, what
sure.
public transportation
sure.
is going
to look
like.
It's all part of the same.
All, yeah.
So instead of what we tend to do in cities like Baltimore is deal with all of these things in a piecemeal fashion, as opposed in a silo fashion, as opposed to a much more integrated fashion of all of this stuff ties together.
Mm-hmm. I had just learned something really interesting in reporting on the demolition plan that Hogan introduced with the mayor last week. Samir Iyer at UB, who studies city demographics, said that if a community reaches 4% vacancy, it stops growing. So the two biggest indicators of a community that will stop growing is residents who have to commute more than, I think it's 75 minutes to a job, so it's a long commute, and then it's a high rate of vacancies. Sandtown, Winchester, and Harlan Park have 33%
wow.
vacancies.
Right.
And actually, that may be low.
Right.
I mean, when you really look in, I did a story on the report that Joan Jacobson wrote for the Able
Foundation.
On the whole vacancy to value program, which has been, you know, is according to the report, been a little stretched in terms of its success rate. But I was doing a stand-up on camera at night, and we were in Sandtown, Winchester, on one of those blocks, like the 1100 block of North Cary, or one of those. They have these huge houses, these row houses, that are totally vacant. And it's a frightening place. You'd be on that, you're on that street at night, and it is,
Absolutely. It's
so foreboding of there's no life, there's no activity, the streetlights kind of half work, and it's like, why are these...
Well, under this demolition plan, up to 20 blocks will be demolished in just this first year. Is that going to make a difference, Yvonne? I mean, is this taking down these vacant houses and turning them into at least initially green space, which will then somehow be, you know, parcelled out or sold or auctioned off to developers? In the short term, number one, does it create any jobs for the people in those communities? And number two, is it going to make it safer? As Jane says, it's scary hanging around those places at night.
So we're still waiting for a lot of details, especially about whether there'll be a local hiring component to any of this. But the people in the community are really, I think, concerned about the execution of this and whether it's going to leave them with big open spaces, which could create, I mean, a park Baltimore County is different than a park in inner city, an open space in inner city Baltimore. You have to feel safe to go there. What's that going to look like? Who's going to maintain it? People are also concerned of this idea that the city, parts of the city could turn into a wasteland like they perceive parts of Detroit to be after the rapid demolition of housing in that city.
And the vacancy to values program plays prominently in this plan to demolish all of these houses. And if it's already overstretched to begin with, what does that
right.
say about
it? The vacancy to value program is really, I think smartly so, concentrated in areas in communities that have something going for them. That's a terrible thing to say, but that's exactly what that program does. So the Oliver community, it's very close to Hopkins, so it's got a natural economic engine nearby. It's succeeding. There are other areas on that east side. I've noticed as I, the Greenmount West community, which had a lot of really ugly blight, is really starting now to become kind of an arts community, et cetera.
So it's the Station North folks
correct.
And stuff.
Yeah. I think we're soon going to hear more of a drumbeat to get rid of that huge blob right, you know, adjacent to the JFX, which is that prison complex, which is just such a downer in terms of vibrancy.
Yeah.
Is
this going to be a major issue in the mayor's race? I mean, we've got such
biggest...
a wide open race here. What are going to be the issues that you see percolating to the top as we get closer to April?
I think the economic issue is... I think it's got to be the number one issue. I mean, you know, I think that if people sit around the table long enough, they start to understand that what happened on April 27th was about a whole lot of things and not one or two. And to start to peel all of that away and understand that, I mean, I mentor a young man and he's told me many times, Jane, $10 an hour is not going to get those guys off the corner.
Mm-hmm.
I know how he struggles and he makes more than $10 an hour. There has to be a vision of a way out.
Of a way out, yeah.
And so I think that and a better relationship with the police department are the two big issues.
Yeah, and Yvonne, just as we finish up here real quick, you wrote a terrific story about how the city council races are wide open too. There's going to be a lot of turnover on the council.
Yeah, my partner and I did dozens and dozens of interviews for the council election race. We're expecting pretty tremendous turnover just by the number of council members who have announced. There's five who have announced that they're not running again.
Yeah, it's going to be a wide open
and
time.
I have a question for Yvonne. Could we still see some retirements?
Anything's possible. All right.
Yeah.
We got to pick this up at another time, but I appreciate both coming in, and we'll talk to you soon. Jane Miller is the award-winning chief investigative reporter for WBAL Television. Yvonne Wenger reports on local government for the Baltimore Sun. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us. Our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, stops by Maryland Morning most Monday mornings. Today, she brings us her review of Moonlight and Magnolias at the Audrey Herman Spotlighters Theater.
In 1939, movie producer David O. Selznick locked screenwriter Ben Hecht and director Victor Fleming in his office for the better part of a week to force Hecht to come up with a screenplay. Most of the details of what took place in that room aren't known, but what came out of it is considered the most popular movie ever made, Gone with the Wind. Moonlight and Magnolias, currently at the Spotlighters Theater, is playwright Ron Hutchinson's speculation about what might have gone on in Selznick's office. Compared to Margaret Mitchell's florid Civil War saga of love, rejection, hope, despair, birth, death, and, of course, the burning of Atlanta, watching a guy sitting at a typewriter isn't exactly earth-shattering. There has been some action before the play begins. Selznick has shut down production and fired the movie's original director, George Cukor, and its original screenwriter, Sidney Howard, who nonetheless ended up getting credit. When the play begins, Selznick already has had rewrites by everyone from Charles MacArthur to F. Scott Fitzgerald. He coerces Hecht into taking the job, only to discover that the newspaper man turned screenwriter may be, as Selznick puts it, the only person on the face of the planet who hasn't read Margaret Mitchell's book. So, Selznick and Fleming act out scenes from the novel for Hecht. It's one of the activities that's actually been documented from that screenwriting cram session. It's also one of the rare instances of dramatic action in Hutchinson's play. Tom Erickson plays a controlling Selznick and Scarlett. Tony Calavito is a wary Fleming, and Ashley and Melanie and even Prissy. And David Shoemaker is Hecht, jaded, sarcastic, and very skeptical.
Then Fleming and I act out the book for you.
Act out the book?
You got a better idea?
The whole book?
Look, we act out a scene from the book. He watches, he writes it up as a movie scene. We move to the next scene. He says, do we need this scene? We can tell the story without it. So we toss that scene. We go to the next scene. At the end of 5 days, we have a movie.
That nobody's going to want to watch, but hey.
There are a few other dramatic touches, including a fight, well and comically choreographed by Larry Malkus. And director Michael Byrne-Zemerol adds some clever bits, particularly the introduction of some of the movie's music at appropriate moments, and a humorous, inspired depiction of Fleming's Melanie about to give birth. Zemerol's actors establish their characters' distinct personalities and rivalries, and a fourth cast member, Rachel Roth, does a notable job imbuing Selznick's assistant with period flair. She may seem like the quintessential yes man or woman, but she wields power of her own.
I checked personally.
With the phone call?
Yes, Mr. Selznick.
That you made yourself?
Yes, Mr. Selznick.
To his house?
Yes, Mr. Selznick.
Where he lives?
Yes, Mr. Selznick.
I want him in here the moment he arrives.
Yes, Mr. Selznick.
Selznick belittles her and everyone else. Hecht rails against the novel's politics. Fleming just wants to get the thing done. The play includes Hollywood gossip, much talk about Selznick's relationship to his father-in-law, studio head Louis B. Mayer, and especially in the second act, long harangues about everything from anti-Semitism to the purpose of movies. Frankly, to borrow some of Margaret Mitchell's most famous words, should we give a damn? Certainly, if you're a huge Gone with the Wind fan. For the rest of us, well, tomorrow is another play.
Moonlight and Magnolias is at the Audrey Herman Spotlighters Theater in Baltimore until January 31st. We've got details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up on the other side of the news, producer Jonna McCone introduces us to local rapper Abdu Ali. Stay with us.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 881, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now another installment in our series on area musicians. Producer Jonna McCone sat down with a local rapper, DJ, and writer to talk about his music, his influences, and the regular dance party he organizes.
My name is Abdu Ali. I'm based in Baltimore. I'm a rapper and writer. Writing is my first passion. I wanted to get back into that this year because it's a lot of things you can't really express through music that you can through writing. And vice versa. Music, I feel like, is more about instant gratification, how your body immediately responds to what is going on in the music, versus writing, I feel like it's more of a cerebral way to get into themes. In my music, I'm more of a preacher, I guess, and it's more about me trying to talk at you so you can understand what I'm trying to say in these messages I'm trying to get to you. My music is very, like, now. It's trying to help you understand things about the world, yourself, you in this world. It's very visceral, very cathartic, very aggressive.
in my green Suzuki hatchback. Never looking back, never looking back through the battlefields of Baltimore.
I grew up in West Baltimore, West Downtown Baltimore, Pennsylvania Avenue, and Martin Luther King, which is historically a rich in black culture. Black bodies. The schools I went to, people like Thurgood Marshall went to, or we got the Billie Holiday statue right up the street from my house. Also the Royal Theater, which used to be a pop and jazz club back in the day, was right up the street from my house. So it's a lot of rich black history in where I grew up. When I was younger, I was always really quiet and shy and very timid, and being in Baltimore, that's kind of hard to be because it's a tough city, you know what I'm saying? After a while, when I got older, I definitely realized how racially segregated the city is and also just how racially shady it can be. I talk about a lot of things like that in my music, just being radically queer and black, no matter what people say, or no matter how hard it is to be that in today's society, you just gotta do it by any means necessary. If you're gonna be gay, black, and rapping, you definitely gotta come hard. You definitely have to be secure in yourself, because the music industry in general is not open to queer people being out and doing music. Westport in the house. Oh my God. Cherry Hill in the house. Oh my God. Of course I had to have Baltimore Club is like the backbone of my music. It's the sound I grew up on. It's the sound I heard when I was real young to today. When I was younger, we would go to parties at the Docks, the Paradox, which is sadly closing down next year. Is a popping underground club that back in the day you would go to on a Friday, Saturday, Thursday night, and it would be packed. And all they would play for 4 or 5 hours is Baltimore club music. And you had Baltimore club dancers dancing the whole night, battling against each other at the Docks. And it was just so vibrant and beautiful. Nobody is like angry. It was a space, and I think the music is for sure helped us to escape, you know, the reality that we were living in, because a lot of people who would go to these clubs were like black young kids in Baltimore. And now, I don't know, it definitely has died a whole lot with all these spaces closing down in Baltimore and the radio not really playing it like they used to, and just a lot of things. It's not as vibrant as it used to be. I mean, it was powerful back in the day. A lot of people wouldn't mix like noise and soul and Baltimore club together and make a new sound. I'm alive, I'm alive. My newer stuff that I'm working on now, and the song Keep Moving, definitely is more soulful. Listening to people like Donny Hathaway, Curtis Mayfield, Stevie Wonder, all these great people from the 70s, Marvin Gaye, they showed me that you can be soulful and soft, but at the same time get a lot of deep and critical messages across. So I was inspired by gospel music and church music. Being inspired by that, it helps people just immediately feel what you're saying, whether it's through the lyrics or the music. So I definitely wanted my stuff to kind of be more soulful, hard, and fast, but at the same time be heavy. My new song, Keep Moving, Negro High, is about, kind of wanted to make a modern day Negro spiritual, especially during the times of 1968 to 1975, you know, civil rights movement, the Vietnam War. Black people needed music to get them together, to help them push through. And I just wanted to make a track that specifically did that. The chorus is just, you know, it's shady and crazy, but we gotta keep moving, baby. You know it's shady and crazy, but we gotta keep moving, baby. You know it's shady and crazy, but we gotta keep moving, baby. We gotta keep And I'm just saying that over and over again, like a mantra. One of my favorite songs to perform, I Exist. It's just about existing within this world as you are, no matter what, and just boldly being you. And a lot of the choruses to my songs are very simple, very accessible, and that's on purpose. I wanted to create a party in Baltimore that brought everybody together. Kalon is probably the most diverse party in Baltimore, probably in the East Coast, probably in this country. Because when you go there, it's just everybody. It's just so many people. And we make it a point to always have women on the bill, always have black people on the bill, you know, because they always have queer people on the bill, because those three minorities don't really ever get space to do what they want to do. The shows in Baltimore that I was going to, especially when I first started performing 3 years ago, especially in the underground indie scene, was very like white male. It's plenty of shows still today that include no women. In Baltimore, I'm one figure who can cross over to a lot of different audiences, and I think it's because my music is about conquering social norms, and one social norm in our society is to be racially segregated.
Abdu Ali speaking with John McCone. On Saturday, he performs with Lower Dens at the Auto Bar, and on January 30th, he hosts the dance party Kalon at the Crown. And Ali has a new mixtape called Mongo. It comes out in February. There's more at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you Wednesday. Have a great day.